But time for our RSN Legends series, Whitey, and we look forward to this every week, and today is no exception. Very comfortable sitting in the status of Legend of Australian Sport. He played 211 games for the mighty Brown and Gold, was a premiership captain in 1971 with Hawthorn. He then went on to become one of the all-time greats in the world of coaching, a four-time premiership coach in the VFL / AFL, and since then, he's been involved in the media for many, many years, doing great things outside of football as well, educating the community from start to finish. Loves education, loves people, loves talking to us here on The Breakfast Club. It's the one and only David Parker. And good morning, Parko.
G'day, half. One great carp coach to another.
One day they might be able to say that, Parko. One, I hope they're able to say that at some stage. How are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. We've both coached runners-up, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Yes, we have.
Thank you for having me there.
Trying to do something about that. We'll work on that. How did the boy from Melbourne High end up in this position, Parker, all these years later? Where did it all start for you?
Well, I guess half because I was resident. I was a Melbourne, mad, lunatic Melbourne supporter. In fact, I still buy my membership because that's where my love of the game half actually started. Ian Ridley was my father's clerk in the State Savings Bank, and I had that association, you know, personal association. So the sad part about all that, half, is I lived about 50 metres from the Hawthorn footy ground. The sad part, but the good part, really, is that I was residentially bound and forced to go and play at Hawthorn, which is probably, when you think back, was probably the greatest fluke or luck in my life, which led to the things that I've been a part of, really.
And was those years of the Melbourne dominance through the 50s would have been great to be a part of as a Melbourne supporter, Parker. Is that the, sort of where the spark was ignited for you?
Yeah, they at that time, and I'm probably looking back in history, were probably the most successful team that ever played. And to be absorbed in that and go to, not only go to grand finals, but to go to grand finals that they were playing, and not only that, but they were also winning. Still is, a vibrant memory.
Parker, you always played down your abilities as a player, but you were a best and fairest winner and captain of Hawthorn, premiership captain of Hawthorn. Describe yourself as a player.
Whitey, the year I won, you should know this, the year I won the best and fairest, you know what position I played, Whitey?
Didn't you play as a forward or something?
No, not good enough to play forward yet. No, back pocket. That's as far back. That's where you go and you watch other people play. And it goes, that's factual. That's why a lot of the very good coaches, now you should know this historically, a lot of the so-called reasonable coaches all were back pocket players because they watched for 90 minutes of the 100 minutes of the game. Well, if you go back and look at the records, if I won that Test and Fairest in whatever it was, 1965, who finished stone motherless last in the competition was Hawthorn. So where was the ball most of the time? Down in the back line. So that's why I won the only best and fairest I ever won was the year when we finished bottom, and my role was to try and protect the goal. So that's the truth, Waddy. I don't put myself as a reasonable player in a very, very good side, and how lucky I was to captain one in 1971, which was one of those, well, probably my happiest, most satisfying, most enjoyable game of football.
I knew you were a back pocket player, but I thought maybe in that year you played forward or did something different to be the best and fairest winner. So what I want to know is that when you were a player, and you turned into the most, remarkable coaches, one of the best, coaching careers there is. Did you know early on that that was what you wanted to do? And were you someone that understood the way the game was unfolding as you were a player? Or did that all happen later in your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't really thought that through. But I didn't have any great desires to become a coach. And it was most unusual, I guess, because I was a teacher and became a physical educator and ended up, would you believe, while I was playing, being responsible for the conditioning, the physical conditioning of my teammates, which wasn't easy to do, as you could imagine. So that gave me a bit of a taste. But I, to be quite honest, and people wouldn't know, but I was assistant coach to John Kennedy in whatever year it was, 1976. And as we were coming from pre-season training, I'll never forget, up in Hewitt Stradbroke Park, it was well into probably end of February, beginning of March. And as we walked across to our cars, John Kennedy put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "Oh, by the way, Dave, you'll be coach of the Hawthorn Football Club tomorrow." And I had no idea. John was under a bit of personal family difficulty at the time and he needed to spend time there with young Bernard. And he actually, no interview, no prior knowledge, he actually gave me his job in the car park in Stradbroke Park after training one night. So, I mean, that would never happen in the modern game, you know, when you think about how coaches... And so that was... And I was quite shocked. I think probably excited, but very, very nervous about taking on that responsibility and not really knowing whether I had the credentials, personal and professional, to get the job done. So it was an interesting, you know, what's the word, introduction and apprenticeship that I did, but I had no great desire prior to that point to actually becoming an AFL coach or VFL coach for what?
So, Parker, when you went home that night and then in the build-up to the game, how did you approach it? Did you get out the exercise book and start taking notes frantically? Did you just go on sort of a gut feel thing? Did you feel that you could do the job? What was that like going home and thinking, geez, all of a sudden, not only am I captain in the team, I'm coaching it?
Whitey, you won't believe this. I went home and rang my seven mates who played. Scotty Matthews, there are seven of them. If you go and look at the seven most experienced players, they're all better footballers than me. They were all playing in that team at that time. And I said, and you probably don't realise that that was the first step in the empowerment process. I went to them, yeah. I said, well, look, I don't know whether I can coach or not, and I'm good mates with you. You are the key to this team or not. Let me know if what we're doing is acceptable, and if what we're saying and trying to achieve is not, you have the decency to let me know. And I'm forever grateful that that group of, I think, seven, there were six or seven players who came round to my house in Mount Waverley. We sat down and had that discussion, so not realising, just terrified about my responsibility, trying to get the blokes on side who are going to make it work or not. Now, it must have worked because we won the premiership the year after in 1978. I think we stuffed it up in 77. and we absolutely did. And in 78, that same group of blokes came back very hard and played and dominated that particular premiership.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Fantastic.
And you're able to confirm that you killed coach. Good players help, Parko, but you know you've got to be able to put that together.
No, Harvey, you and I both know that good and great players make a half reasonable coach. I don't know too many coaches who have been claimed or titled afterwards as great coaches who coached very ordinary teams and did amazingly well with them. You can start naming them for me, but all the great coaches of my time in the game, last 70-odd years, have usually had great teams and wonderful players to work with. You know, absolute fact.
So you won the flag in 78 with the Hawks, and then 2 years later, effectively, you're at the Blues. What happened there?
What happens to most coaches? Huh? What happened?
Just got sacked.
I got sacked, yeah.
2 years before you win the flag and you get sacked.
Yeah, well, you should ask. I've been asking that question for a long time. I was very, very disappointed, very hurt. But they were right because... when you think about it, who followed me? Alan Jeans, who's the most successful Hawthorn coach, I think, of all. Well, Clarkson is now obviously probably the greatest coach of all time. Any vintage is Al. But it was great for Alan Jeans. I mean, for the Hawthorn Football Club through Alan Jeans. And it was good for me because I ended up basically with the premiership team at Carlton. So how lucky was I? When you look back at the time, I was very offended and disappointed and hurt and all those sorts of things, but it was good for everybody. I think everybody, me included.
Can I ask you the difference in the experience going to Carlton? Because as you said before, you at Hawthorn, you knew the players, you had a good core group of mates there that you'd play with and you'd known really well. And you go to Carlton, and I imagine you didn't know many, if any, of the players. So you come in as that real outlier coach. How different was that experience to coaching Hawthorn?
Yeah, at the other end, that's a very good question. At the other end of the continuum, what the culture and history of Hawthorn was in comparison to the culture and history of the Carlton Football Club, you couldn't have two more diametrically opposed organisations, in a sense. I mean, it was just, it was unbelievable. The only contact I had was with a bloke called Kevin Heath, who I attacked at Hawthorn. And when I went in my first meeting at the Carlton Football Club, and I had the players for the very first time half, in the players' room there, I'd been introduced and was about to speak, and Kevin Heath stood up in the back of the room, walked down the steps to the front, shook me by the hand, and said, I've changed, in front of his face. And they're all calling out, suck, suck, suck. You know? So, sadly, I had to sack Kevin at the end of that year too, which is, again, so I checked, he's probably the only player I've sacked twice.
Poor old Kev.
And he still talks to me. I can't believe that.
remarkable story. But you did have great success. I was 81-82. Were great years for the Blues.
They'd won in 79.
Yep.
Finished on top, I think, again in 80. And with a bunch, I think, three or four very significant players unavailable by injury, I think, and maybe suspension. Peter Jones wasn't able to get the job done. So how fortunate I was. And that team half is never recognised, unfortunately, along with the great Brisbane teams or the great Melbourne teams or great Essendon teams, etc. But they won 3 out of 4 years. And outstanding group of players and really collectively an outstanding team. I think 95 might have been a better team in a real sense, because that's the group that took total ownership over everything, which is not well understood these days, but they decided who would play. They picked the third. They decided how we would play. They debriefed their performance, as all clubs do now, individually and collectively, and they set the values and behaviours that we would live by as a club, and then actually meted out the penalties for anybody who stepped outside of those. So that was a new, unique experience in 95, but in historical sense, that group in the early 80s was as good as any, I think, to grace the fields in VFL AFL history.
Parker, you talk a lot about that Carlton era where, as you said, they won 3 premierships in the space of 4 years, and I'm not saying you get defensive, but you're quite sensitive that it doesn't get the recognition that it deserves. Why were they so good?
The interesting thing, and they were led by, you know, Mike Fitzpatrick wasn't one of the boys. His leadership on and off the field has been absolutely outstanding. I've been spending a bit of time with him down here at Point Longstaff in isolation, and he's a unique character. I mean, the football in crucial games and in significant moments in crucial games, there was no better, I think Wayne Johnson probably in the same class, but there was no better contributor. But if the game had no consequence in the sense of the season or the opponent we were playing, Mike Fitzpatrick had trouble getting himself up. But his intelligence and leadership and understanding was a significant feature in that team. But the rest were the greatest load of larrikins and unstable extroverts that I've ever come across anywhere in my life. Well, it would be except for Bruce Newell, of course. Bruce, I don't think he's ever spoke to me. He made one of the few errors I've ever seen him make. He went up behind Terry Bright at Geelong, who had those long arms, and he went to market, and unfortunately, Terry caught it, which I sent the runner out. Hell, Dooley to punch the ball when he's behind. So what was interesting is that the runner came back and there was a message that came. I got the telephone call from the runner. We don't have two-way conversations, just one way. And the runner said, message from Bruce too. I said, my God, what did he say? I've never heard him speak. He said, tell Park and I don't have the runner. So, to be truthful, I never, ever sent the runner to Bruce Toole again. But they were of all the guys that I've been associated with in footy clubs in different roles, they were, when you think of them, the McClures and the Disastos and the Johnsons and the Buckleys and you name them, they were Southies and Tools, and they were a unique group. They were the closest, bonded group, I think I could call it, that I had met in footy. And with the talent they had and the belief in each other and the closely knit nature of that group, they were able to achieve a remarkable thing.
So you coached four premierships across Hawthorn and then two spans at Carlton. But you talk so fondly of your time at Fitzroy, where you did have success as well. You got the Lions to a preliminary final in your first year in 86. Did you coach Fitzroy the same way as you coached Carlton? You said you had all that talent at Carlton. Was it the same philosophies you then embarked with Fitzroy?
Look, that's a good question, Whitey. But they were, if you go and have a look back, leading up to me taking over in, what was it, 86, was it? 1986.
Yeah.
They had been a very successful team. Hadn't won it. Should have probably won the one that they didn't win. I can't think. It's a classic story. Yeah, 83 was the one that they probably should have won. But they were one of the more talented, even looking in comparison with the Hawthorn team and the Carlton team. That Fitzroy team, when I got them in 86, were a very, very talented group and very, very close and achieved a lot together. And what we did, I think we had to win the last two games, which we won by less than two kicks to get into the finals. We won the first final against Essendon at Waverley by a point. The second one against Sydney, I think, at the MCG by 4 points. So we're in a preliminary final against the Hawks. We actually kicked the first two goals. We were on our knees. Ruzzi was injured and couldn't play, but put his hand up 5 minutes before the game when he sensed what was happening or wasn't happening. Had an injection in his ankle and went out and played. I admire him enormously for that. Grant Laurie, who has dropped at the last minute, has never spoken to me since. But they went out, and you won't remember, they went out and they kicked the first two goals without Hawthorn touching the ball. Now, the fact is Hawthorn kicked the next 13 goals without us kicking one, I think, was probably the difference. But I look back on that team. It went downhill from that point on, sadly. I was hitting Blakes and demanding of them things that got past them, and they hated me and made sure that the finish I was thrown out the door, which was right from their point of view and right from my point of view too. So the first year of that three-year contract was as satisfying as any of the years when you compare what you have to work with and the result they achieved. We optimised, I think, the talent of that group.
Yep. Now, I know Fitzroy fans still talk of that year very fondly, Parker, so you've certainly made an indent into their history of the mighty Fitzroy Football Club, of course, no longer with us. Just on your career outside of footy, Parker, as you mentioned before, a physical educator for generations. Where do you get more satisfaction, with the physical educating or the coaching?
Good question, huh? Haven't really thought about it too much, except that I couldn't give up. I was probably the last coach. Sure, I was. I can't think of maybe Malcolm Blight, but I was the last coach to remain semi-professional. I never, ever went full-time coaching at any stage of my career. I always had the work, the lecturing work at Deakin University. I thoroughly enjoyed. I think I was able to influence and impact and help build A, relationships, and B, the competences required to do that job. So I get as much satisfaction talking to my ex-students and listening to their stories and finding out what they've done, as I do with my footballs, in a real sense. So I was lucky enough that A, the university allowed me to do the football, and B, that the Carlton Football Club recognised that I needed some balance in my life because I was a lunatic. And I think, so both were satisfying, and now I'm not doing either. I have to be absolutely honest with you, I miss both. But I miss the relations, you know, Harper and Whitey too. It's both our relationship businesses, you know, sport, whether it's professional or not, or teaching, whether it's primary kids or tertiary students. It's a personal bond between two people. It's a face-to-face thing. And, well, I'm not so good on Zoom and all the things that we're using these days, because I miss the actual contact, the actual body language and sense and feel and smell and taste, those things. So the world has changed a lot, and how lucky I was that both my employers agreed for me to keep, well, they probably realised that one way or the other I'd be a lunatic, so probably keeping the balance was a good idea for me, but probably for the organisation which I represented.
I reckon it's worked out pretty well for both. And just before we let you go, you did have a publicised battle with prostate cancer back in 2009. That impact on that, on your life, and what that perhaps did for your perspective on the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, look, you're right. It's the only time I've had to face up to something that might have been more difficult, caused me more problems than it did. But I was very fortunate. Tony Costello, who was my urologist, and his nurse, Helen Crowe, certainly helped me through that stage of my life, going through the removal of the prostate and the rehabilitation afterwards. And I know they've gone on to build what is the Australian Prostate Centre now in North Melbourne. I certainly spent some time there, and I think the last, when it was 8 or 9 years, they've done some terrific work in research and support for patients, etc. I'm working with my own, I guess, foundation. We're the Mailbag Foundation. We ride postage motorbikes all over Australia, and I've been a bit of fun on those, raising money. We've raised $1.5 million. So there's some great work being done by the Prostate Cancer Foundation, by the Australian Prostate Centre, and by organisations like the Mailbag Foundation to try and get the money raised, the research done, support for, like Helen Crowe being a nurse afterwards, what's done for patients in their recovery is terribly important, I think, and that support is required. And where women, Harp and Whitey, have done a brilliant job with their nurses to support women who have gone down the breast cancer pathway, we're a long, long way behind men. We're a long way behind in looking after men, and more men will die of prostate than women will die of breast cancer, but we've been slow to get that job done. So I'm delighted when organisations like the APC are working very hard to get that research done and the support to help men through what's a pretty pretty difficult time in their lives if they happen to go down with prostate cancer.
Yeah, well, it's nice to have people, I'm sure, from their perspective, like you, being able to help with that message as well, Parker. It's a joy to spend any time with you, and one day soon, hopefully, we will get to shake your hand and you can be able to see the body language and smell and taste and touch and all that sort of stuff, and that'd be nice for all of us, I reckon. But it's great to have you on the program this morning, mate. We appreciate it. Hope you're well.
Thanks, Harp, and thanks, Whitey. Good to catch up.